This is the Takeaway Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. We are broadcasting from Washington, D.C. today in the domain of our colleague Todd Zwillick, who will join us in just a moment to assure us that the government will not or will be shutting down when Congress finally gets past this Syria crisis and gets down to the business of the budget and the U.S. economy. We came to D.C. yesterday and sat down for a rare, very candid and freewheeling interview with Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It was a remarkable moment. She was tough, smart, razor-sharp, sat with us for more than a half an hour to talk about the law, the court, the state of government in 2013. We will have that for you next week on the program. But first, while the diplomats work, the U.S. military seems to have pulled back from the brink in the Syria crisis. We wanted to get an assessment from the Pentagon side of all this. While U.S. and Russian officials speak about a possible diplomatic settlement, the United Nations makes another attempt to change the brutality in the longstanding Syrian civil war. Joining us now is Chief Pentagon Spokesman George Little. Welcome to the program, George.
Good to be here. Delighted.
Do you share in the notion that fear of a military strike changed the game diplomatically, or did the civilians kind of back into something here?
There is absolutely no question, John, that the credible threat of military force absolutely prompted this diplomatic process that's underway in Geneva right now. Without this threat of military force, it's highly unlikely that the Russians and the Syrians would have engaged in this process that we're seeing playing out right now.
Some weeks ago, your boss, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, said that the plans are ready, that the Pentagon was able to move at a moment's notice. Are you clear on what the plans were as we got to the brink and now we're back from it? And what's the Pentagon doing now?
We are an organization that constantly plans. We are postured at this very moment to act if we were to be directed to take military action by the President of the United States. We have assets in the region to include Navy ships in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea. And, of course, we have other assets in that part of the world. We're obviously waiting for this diplomatic process to play out. But if we were ordered to go by the President of the United States, we would absolutely act, and we're ready.
Just because I can't resist, the President was asked extensively about this in his interviews with the news media and speaking to the American people. You can confirm the Pentagon does not do pinpricks?
I can assure you that this would not be a pinprick if we were to engage in military action. This would be a significant strike that would deter and degrade the Syrian regime's chemical weapons stockpiles.
All right, let me talk to you about something that a number of our listeners have noted and that we've attempted to get to the bottom of ourselves, that while there are no plans for boots on the ground in Syria, and the president has ruled that out, Secretary of State John Kerry has ruled that out, there are plenty of U.S. advisors, U.S. military personnel in an advisory capacity in the region, in Jordan, in Turkey, with the missile batteries at Incirlik. Are you absolutely assured that those personnel are safe if things could get out of hand in Syria?
We obviously take our force protection very seriously, and we do have military advisors in countries nearby, in Jordan and Turkey and in Israel. We have been conducting prudent military planning with our counterparts and allies in the region, and we will take every step necessary to protect them. We hope it doesn't spill over, of course, beyond Syria's borders.
But you have to be concerned that among the possible military counterstrikes or responses to any U.S. military action would be an attempt to get a hostage or get someone with a U.S. military uniform.
We're prepared for the full range of possible contingencies in the form of responses, and we stand ready to act if required.
Talking to George Little, the chief Pentagon spokesman. George, can you give us some clarity on what the state of arms transfer is to the Syrian opposition? Is the U.S. military involved in the logistics on that? Is that actually happening now? Have we upgraded the weapons that we're sending to the opposition?
The Defense Department is actually not in the lead. Other agencies in our government are leading the effort to step up our assistance to the moderate opposition in Syria. As you know, we have provided non-lethal support to the Syrian opposition for a long time. and we'll continue to do that. And the president has directed that there be additional assistance provided.
Now, you know, again, this is from our listeners, and I think it's a sentiment that is probably not something you've heard for the first time from me. But some folks, including veterans on our program, have suggested that there is a possibility that U.S. weapons would be in the hands of al-Qaeda jihadists in Syria, people who may have actually killed U.S. military personnel during the worst of the violence in Iraq in 2006. What efforts are being made to prevent that from happening, and is it a concern of the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel?
It's a very fair question, and as you know, there is a patchwork of opposition groups inside Syria. We've been working very hard, primarily through the State Department, to identify what the moderate opposition groups are, to engage with them in a diplomatic process, and to vet them. We believe that we are bringing greater cohesion to the moderate opposition, and we understand who we can and cannot work with, and who we should and should not engage with. This is a very important question. We realize that it's complicated and complex, but we're tackling the problem, and we believe that we're making good progress.
I know you can't talk about chain of command stuff too much, George Little, but can you assure me or our veteran listeners that that decision is going to be made on the ground close to Syria and not in the White House or at the Pentagon, that someone, if they see a weapon getting into the hands of somebody who they would describe as a jihadist, that they could make the decision to prevent that from happening?
Well, I can't speculate on every hypothetical, John, as you can imagine, but our general view on all of this is that those kinds of tactical decisions are best left to commanders on the ground.
All right. George Little, thanks so much.
John, thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
George Little is the chief Pentagon spokesman. He spoke to us from his office in the Pentagon. From the Pentagon across the Potomac to the domain, Mr. Todd Zwillick, Capitol Hill, where Congress has been given a timeout on the Syria crisis for the time being. And that means everything that was on the agenda is looming once again. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins me now. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John. Haven't heard that track in a while.
Yeah, isn't that nice? Great, yeah. Sort of dusted that off since we're in your town.
That's right. Welcome.
And so we're great to be here in the steamy end of summer days of Washington, which means a lot of things. In this case, it really means that some things that were much more familiar when the weather was colder, debt ceiling, government shutdown, these are all looming again, and they're debates that are going to start up.
They all were, and everyone on Capitol Hill knew that when the Syria debate was raging, and it's still out there, but Congress has a reprieve from actually having to take a position on Syria now, at least a public one, those two issues are coming back, and these are not votes of choice. The current government funding structure expires at midnight on September 30th. We all know what that means. No agreement equals government shutdown. About 2 weeks after that, we're due to hit the debt limit again, and here are Republicans yet again, John, demanding concessions for each of these things. We've seen part of this movie before, but the first part of it is a lot scarier for John Boehner than it used to be. The fight really isn't so much about spending on the government shutdown. The fight is Republican on Republican, and really it's about Obamacare. John, you have a John Boehner's right, the conservatives, the Tea Partiers, 30 or 35 or 40 members strong, which is enough to scuttle anything he wants to do, at least without the help of Nancy Pelosi, demanding that a repeal of Obamacare, a defund, be part of a continuing resolution.
And that's the other big collision here, because a part of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, goes into effect on October 1st.
It does. That's the other part of this. The other deadline is that the exchanges launch on October 1st. The subsidies start flowing at that time. And that's a deadline for these conservatives. They know they've already had two elections. They've had a Supreme Court decision on Obamacare, none of which went in their favor, although arguably the election of 2010 definitely did go in Republicans' favor. The other two things did not. They know this is their last best chance. Republicans on the Hill will tell you that after October, Obamacare becomes an entitlement that the public is used to, for better or for worse. People who are getting the benefits won't want to lose them. This is their last best chance to do it.
So how is Speaker Boehner feeling about his unruly
unruly GOP caucus.
He's got to be feeling pretty terrible at the moment. Here's why. He is fighting a Republican-on-Republican battle. Forget about being able to get to the table with Reid and Pelosi and negotiate over actual spending levels, which is a big enough fight, and he may get a little bit of a win there. He's fighting his own people on Obamacare. What they tried to do earlier this week, John, the Republican leaders in the House, was put a bill on the floor, a continuing resolution to avoid a government shutdown, that had a provision in it that said, yes, House conservatives, you can vote on attaching repeal of Obamacare to this thing. But it was structured in a way that they didn't like. It was structured in a procedurally funny way that would send it to the Senate and let the Senate just kind of slough it off, not really have to latch it on to a continuing resolution. John, they rebelled. No Republican votes. They had to yank it off the floor because it never got a vote. It would have failed because of lack of Republican support.
And we've seen market jitters as a result of the Syria crisis. I'm wondering, as we get closer and closer to both this and the debt ceiling crisis, which is 2 weeks later, if we're going to see market distortions and all kinds of, you know, nightmare scenarios proceeding once again.
This is one of the fears on Capitol Hill, and this is one of the external dynamics that enters into the debt limit debate. Look, there is a lot of dust and a lot of sort of media frenzy over a government shutdown. I'm here to tell you that it's pretty unlikely that one will happen. There's not a great deal of appetite on Capitol Hill for a government shutdown, except on the right, the repeal Obamacare people, and they just don't have the numbers. They're putting a lot of pressure on Boehner, and they're kind of stirring up a lot of intra-party strife right now. But Boehner can get around them if he turns to Nancy Pelosi. The Democrats don't really want to shut down. They feel like they're in the power seat here. They're going to fight a little bit over spending, but then it is on to the debt limit, and that gets a little scarier. And then the markets may get jittery if John Boehner sticks to his guns on the debt limit.
Finally, Stephen Colbert did a whole hour on Vladimir Putin's op-ed in the New York Times. I gather a lot of members of Congress are a little jealous that Putin got such a high profile.
Got a whole bunch of reaction yesterday. John Boehner said when he read that op-ed, he was insulted. Harry Reid said, well, I don't think it's such a bad thing. At least we're having a debate, but Putin just wants to show off his Super Bowl ring. Nancy Pelosi made a remark about the last line of that op-ed, which says, we're all equal under God's eyes. And she says, gee, I sure hope that applies to gays and lesbians in Russia, Vladimir.
Wow. Could a speech before a joint session of Congress be far behind for Vladimir Putin? Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. Have a good weekend, won't you?
Thanks. I'll try here in steamy Washington.
Here in steamy Washington, Todd Zwillick is Takeaway Washington correspondent. Later this hour, as we mark the five-year anniversary of the financial collapse, two movies are being released to coincide with the event. We're asking you if you could name a feature-length film about the Great Recession. You got a title? Tampa, Florida. Fall of the Titans, one of you in Pleasanton, California, Big Money Blues, Brentwood, New York, Take the Bunny and Run. No more calls, we have a winner. Of course, more calls. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your suggested movie title for the financial collapse of 5 years ago. This is The Takeaway.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Twitter. Everybody does it. It's easy as pie, right? Just 140 characters, and you too can broadcast your little bits of wisdom to the world. Justin Bieber's latest tweet, big news, I got a mosquito bite on my neck and it is really itchy. Or the Pope's latest tweet, Jesus is the sun and Mary is the dawn, announcing his rising. Oh, and this is really trending today. We've confidentially submitted an S-1 to the SEC for a planned IPO. This tweet does not constitute an offer of any securities for sale. That's actually the tweet from Twitter. Is your Twitter experience worth $10 billion, $40 billion, $100 billion? Lots of folks are seeing zeros today as Twitter has announced in that tweet that the company is taking itself public sometime between now and possibly the end of the year. Joining us now on what going public might mean for the future of Twitter is David Gelis, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, David.
Hi.
So lots of comparisons to the Facebook IPO, at least in terms of scale. What are the challenges for Twitter to sort of outline its business model to likely investors people who are maybe a little bit more thoughtful than the I just have to get in on the ground floor techie IPO crazoids who will take the stock without even thinking.
Well, in a funny way, Facebook, its arch rival, has actually made that task a bit easier for Twitter. A year and a half ago, when Facebook went public, there were a lot of doubts about whether Facebook could truly monetize mobile advertising. But since then, especially in recent quarters, Facebook has done just that. And that's exactly what Twitter's value proposition is going to be. They believe that they can turn their hundreds of millions of active users into profitable vehicles for advertising, both on mobile platforms and on the web.
You know, one of the things that's a little bit interesting about Twitter versus Facebook, I mean, Facebook is kind of a place that you go and you look at people's, you know, photos and their postings and that sort of thing. Twitter is a little more ethereal in the sense that you do a tweet and it goes out there. You don't necessarily stick on the Twitter page or any particular Twitter place, which I think complicates the issue of the advertising model for revenue. Yes?
Yeah, it is kind of a stream that people jump in and out of. For advertisers, though, the fact that Twitter really is a place where people go when there's something important to discuss gives them the opportunity to kind of insert themselves in the discussion, whatever that might be.
What are the hints of a possible valuation here? I mean, obviously, I don't want you to get too speculative here, but there are some big investors. If I'm not mistaken, Microsoft has a stake in Twitter. Some other big players have a stake, at least in a sort of, you know, like the venture capital stage of stock in Twitter. So we can make some sketchy calculations, right?
Absolutely. The first venture capital investment came into Twitter in June 2007. Since then, they've taken on successive rounds at ever higher valuations. At the same time, a robust secondary market for Twitter shares has sprung up, much as it did before the Facebook IPO. Now, these are kind of two separate things. On the one hand, there's the agreements between Twitter and its venture capitalist investors, and they've pegged a valuation to the company. At the same time, though, this secondary market where Twitter employees can sell stock directly to individuals is very unregulated. And the secondary market valuation of Twitter has, you know, soared as high as $15 billion. Whereas what we're hearing from people who know the company better is that the company feels its valuation, and the company has been valuing its own stock internally with investors and through an acquisition it just did recently, at closer to $10 billion.
So what is the mission for Twitter as it now goes on the road and does a little, you know, basically sales job in advance of this IPO, which we understand Goldman Sachs will probably be the lead underwriter of?
Well, the truth is there's a lot of mystery still, because while they announced that they were on the road to going public and they had started to file papers with the SEC, they did it under this unique clause with the Jobs Act, which allows them essentially to withhold most of the information, all the nitty-gritty stuff that people would really want to know about the company, until 3 weeks before they actually start marketing to investors. And we don't know when that's going to be. So there's still a bit of a waiting game before we actually get to see how Twitter's going to pitch itself, what its real numbers are.
And finally, there were a whole lot of things that came together in that perfect storm when Facebook's IPO happened. And, you know, some of it had to do with the NASDAQ. Some of it had to do with things that were completely out of Facebook's control. What are the assurances that that fiasco isn't going to be repeated, David?
Well, there really are no assurances. That said, I think by doing this Jobs Act IPO, Twitter is trying to take steps to downplay the scrutiny. There was so much frenzied speculation. There was a lot of information going back between Facebook and investors ahead of the IPO. It really muddied the waters. I think NASDAQ has probably learned a lot, though we don't know, frankly, whether Twitter will list on the NASDAQ or the NYSE. And it's interesting that Twitter seems to have tapped Goldman Sachs, not Morgan Stanley, which led the Facebook IPO. So read what you will into that decision.
Any idea what its ticker symbol would be?
Maybe TWT.
Yeah, which also means twit. So, yeah, who knows? It may come back to haunt them. David Gelis is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
5 years since the global financial crisis. This weekend, we'll see the releases of two movies about the crash in 08. Reviews coming from Movie Date co-host Kristen Meinzer and WNYC economics editor Charlie Herman. Oh, yeah. Charlie's a great reviewer. He'll be here to explain the backstories in these economic movies. But we asked you if you had to come up with a movie title about the 08 crash, what would it be? Stephanie Myers in Braintree, Massachusetts, Reckless, like that. One of you in Anoka, Minnesota, put a tarp over it. Maybe they won't notice. I love that. A few others suggested from you around the country include Stillwater, Minnesota, Honey, I Shrunk Our Wallets, Our Home Value, etc., etc. Just end that one at wallets. That's brilliant. San Jose, California, Breaking Bank. Oh, Oyster Bay, New York, The Ones Who Got Away. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It will be a death penalty for the four convicted perpetrators of one of the most horrible crimes in Indian history, the public rape and murder of a young girl on a moving bus in Delhi last year. Joining us now to discuss the sentence is Veena Venugopal, a journalist based in Delhi and author of Would You Like Some Bread with that book. Veena, you covered this story. Give us a sense, first of all, of the significance and remind us of the details of this crime.
Well, the crime was a brutal gang rape in December 2012 of a girl who had just stepped out from watching the movie The Life of Pi with her friend. They hailed down a bus and they got into the bus. There were six men on board, and they were found a few hours later lying by the side of the road naked, and eventually they were taken to a hospital where the details of the case of what happened came out in the papers the following day, and it was a brutal rape where the men had even used an iron rod which had damaged the intestines of the girl. And it completely chilled India because it happened in a Tony neighborhood, as it were. It happened fairly early in the evening. It was about 9:30, and it happened to one of us in modern India, not in rural India, where a lot of these things happen all the time and we don't really pay much attention to it.
How closely followed was this trial, and how surprised were people that these four were convicted? And then we'll talk for a moment about the death penalty sentence.
It wasn't surprising at all that the four were convicted. On Tuesday, when the court came back with the verdict, they had mentioned that this is the rarest of rare case. For someone to be given the death penalty in India, the case had to be termed as rarest of rare. So it was fairly certain then that they would be given the death penalty. There were six of them. Initially, one who was a juvenile, so who was underage to be tried as an adult, and he got away, as it were, with a light sentence of 3 years. There was much chest beating at the time. There was even an attempt to file a change in legislation bringing down the age of juveniles down so that this boy could have been treated like an adult, but that did not happen. Soon after, the main man convicted of the crime committed suicide in jail. So that left the four of them. And because the crime was so brutal, and also because the crime sort of jolted the country, it was fairly inevitable that the four of them would be given the death punishment.
We're talking with Veena Venugopal, a journalist based in Delhi. Veena, does this represent closure for Indians? And it's been reported that as the young girl slipped away, she held on horribly for a number of days and was said to have told people that she wished that the people who had done this to her would be burned alive. Is there a sense that this represents closure?
It was reported that she said that there is a sense that this represents closure for this case and the family. The family has made an announcement today that they're happy with the verdict and that they are at peace. But for women in India and this whole sort of women's movement in India, this is just the beginning.
Veena Venugopal, a journalist based in Delhi, author of the book, Would You Like Some Bread With That Book? Veena, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work.
Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
Check out the big brain on bread.
It's Movie Friday, and here with us, as always, Kristen Meinzer, Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Day podcast. Also with her, Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC. Why, Charlie? Well, instead of the big commercial releases this weekend, the De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer comedy The Family and the horror flick Insidious Chapter 2, we're going to focus on a pair of documentaries about the financial crisis 5 years ago, one in limited release in theaters today called Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve. The other, which is going directly to Netflix subscribers on Monday, is called Hank, 5 years from the Brink, about Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury. Kristen, Charlie, welcome.
Hello. Hi, John.
So let's start. Listen to Money for Nothing.
The Federal Reserve has the power to create money. If you or I run the printing press in our basement, we're counterfeiters. When the Federal Reserve runs the printing press, the electronic printing press, it's monetary policy.
Charlie, I have to figure that the producers of Riddick are really happy that this movie is coming out this weekend. First of all, is it factually accurate, and is it a good movie to watch?
I think it makes an argument that the Federal Reserve is at the center of a lot of the economic crises that we've had over the past couple of decades, in particular the one that happened 5 years ago. I mean, it really puts it at the center of the wheel for what happened, and you can make that argument, which the movie does. But whether or not you really subscribe to it, I don't think that it is quite accurate to blame everything on them. And in fact, talking to one of the people interviewed in the movie for a show that we do here at WNYC, he said he doesn't quite agree with that argument, even though the movie may make it look like he does. So I think there's definitely something they're trying to push there.
Kristen Meinzer, so is this a good conspiracy movie if you buy the premise?
It certainly feels like a conspiracy theory, but it also feels a lot like propaganda. Very glossy, beautiful propaganda. It has movie clips in it, archival footage, tons of talking heads of every famous person you know who's ever worked for the Fed. Plus, it has the wonderful star power of Liev Schreiber serving as the narrator of the movie. But that heavy-handed narration, that thesis that it's all the Fed's fault, by the end, it gets a little tiresome, but I would recommend watching the first 10 minutes just to find out how the Fed works if you don't know what the Fed's all about and why it was created.
He had a tough thing to do. I mean, how do you explain something that doesn't lend itself necessarily to video and pictures?
Through Frankenstein
policy.
Clips,
well, yeah,
and Jenga games.
But is it a lost opportunity? I mean, does this come off kind of like 9/11 inside job sort of thing?
In that vein, it's trying to make this argument. And again, there are some very valid points in there, but I think towards the end it starts really going towards this direction of the Rand Paul idea of getting rid of the Fed or questioning really what its value is. And that's a good debate to have, but I'm not sure that you can put all the blame for the financial crisis simply on the back of Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan.
All right, so let's just blame it on the Secretary of the Treasury, the direct-to-Netflix film Hank, 5 years from the Brink. Listen.
The whole reason I'm doing this is not because I want to look back, but because I have increasingly come to the view that it's important that there be a historical record for those that come after me. So we don't replay this movie all over again.
So, Charlie, what'd you think?
I think that this is what the movie is. It's trying to continue this process that he's really starting, which he keeps saying over and over, is he feels bad that out of the financial crisis, he was not able to really explain to the American people what the government, what the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve was trying to do to save the economy. And I feel like this is a continuation of that argument that he's trying to make, that you know, our actions were honorable.
Christian Meinzer, a final thought?
Well, this is a very different movie from Money for Nothing. It's all Hank, all the time, just talking, looking back on his life, on his story. Once in a while, his wife pipes in with a little story about how they were courting or how stressed he was during the financial meltdown. But he's not the most charismatic guy, and he's painted just as an ordinary person in a bad situation. And if you want to see a movie about an ordinary guy, here it is.
He's definitely comes across as honest and has a lot of integrity, but it is a bit of a one-sided movie.
Well, two options if you don't want to see Riddick this weekend. Hank, 5 years from the brink, and Money for Nothing. Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC, and Kristen Meinzer of the Movie Day podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks so much, John.
Elvis has left the building, finally. Once upon a time, a teeny little spacecraft named Voyager was launched. It left our world and went on a long, long journey.
Feature. V-O-Y-A-G-E-R. Voyager. Voyager 6.
That's Voyager come back as an alien mutation called V'ger. Of course, in Star Trek, it had been accidentally programmed to wipe out all life in the universe. Oops. We can only wonder what real adventures the V'ger, Voyager, will have now that it is confirmed, NASA announced this week, Voyager, NASA's little Elvis, has finally left the solar system. Of course, there's no sound in space, but this is the sound of the electromagnetic pulses and waves of the ionized gas in interstellar space. Sent back to us by the real Voyager. Only 12 billion miles away, that interstellar spatial ionized gas. Joining us now is Kelly Beatty, senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly, welcome.
Hey, hello.
I miss Voyager already, buddy.
I know. It's been, you know, this is an announcement that's been 36 years in the making. Even before they launched this spacecraft, they knew they had an outside chance to cross this threshold to interstellar space if they have. And it's really exciting for all the scientists involved.
And the goodbye has been really, really long. I remember in the early 90s, Voyager turned around once it passed the orbit of Pluto and snapped a photo of all the planets in line, the first view looking back from Pluto at all the other planets right to the sun. And that was really poignant, I remember.
Right. And since that time, Voyager 1 has made it even farther out. I mean, it's escaping our solar system entirely. It will never come back. It's about 125 times farther from the sun than we are, 3 times farther than Pluto is. So it is definitely out there.
Well, of course, it could come back if you buy the Star Trek line. Once it meets an alien civilization and in 300 years comes back in some giant Borg to wipe out all life in the universe. What's Voyager's first encounter after the solar system, do you think?
Well, it's heading in the direction of a distant star whose name escapes me at the moment. Sorry. But, it, you know, at the speed that it's traveling, which is tens of thousands of miles per hour, it's still not going to reach it for centuries because stars are incredibly far away. And so it's the fact that our sun is a star that makes this transition possible. We're kind of living in a bubble created by the sun. Think of it as a force field if you want to keep with the Star Trek theme. That protects us from encountering interstellar space. It's a magnetized bubble, and it's that bubble that Voyager 1 has crossed out of and into interstellar space. We can see a distinct change in the character of what's inside versus what's outside, and that's what the big news is all about.
Can it send from that distance any useful information about this outside of the solar system, you know, the world outside the bubble?
Oh, you bet. The first call, if you will, that it was outside the bubble was actually last August. And the reason it knew that is that suddenly the number of cosmic rays went way up. This this bubble, this electromagnetic bubble of the sun, protects us from cosmic rays largely. And suddenly there were a whole bunch of cosmic rays. But the scientists didn't believe that they had actually crossed over because the direction of the magnetic field around it hadn't changed, and they expected to see a change in that. So it's been complicated to try to understand if they're really outside or not, and finally they have some ironclad proof that that's the case.
So this is what they've been arguing about since last August.
That's right. What they've been arguing about is literally the direction of the magnetic field. And what was released yesterday was that little sound clip that you played is the sound that there are waves in this, very much like sound waves. And the pitch of those waves goes up when the number of electrons goes up. And that's what it's literally a proxy for how much radiation is around it. And the radiation has, the pitch went up, the radiation has gone up. They said, you know, done deal.
Well, let's just talk about that because, of course, there is no sound in space. And when you say proxy, basically some sort of sensors, electromagnetic sensors on Voyager are measuring the ions, the positive or negatively charged gas atoms and molecules, I suppose, that are hitting it, and the sort of frequency, the rhythm of that hitting produces those waves. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, you need to think of this bubble as being filled with a very tenuous gas, much thinner than we're used to here, and it is out there consisting almost entirely of ionized atoms and electrons. Now, because it is a gas, it is possible to have waves of energy, very much like acoustic waves, like sound waves. And it's those plasma waves that the spacecraft was picking up, and that's what you played. It has a plasma. We encounter a lot of plasma waves in the vicinity of Voyager's original targets, Jupiter and Saturn and so forth. So that's why it was included. But it's always been sort of in the back pocket of a way to detect this interstellar medium.
Wow. Well, you know, aside from all those kind of molecular and astrophysical issues, what do you think the psychic significance is of having this connection to an object that humans created 12 billion miles away?
Hey, you know, I think that if you want to think of it this way, getting back to Voyager, Voyager 1 is now the first object immersed in an environment that is completely alien to it. I mean, up until a year ago, it was, you know, sort of on the fringes of being in its home neighborhood, and now it's gone. And I think it's heady stuff. You know, ordinarily we think of the solar system as the edge of it as being where the planets stop, but it's really more than that. It's this threshold, and actually it's where the sun's gravitational influence ends, which is still some ways out there.
And that's the joy. Voyager is still out there. So great. See you later, Voyager. Kelly Beatty is Senior Contributing Editor of Sky and Telescope Magazine. Thanks so much. Well, this hour we're asking you for the movie title you'd give to the financial collapse of 2008. We'd love to know. 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can weigh in. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
The population of the world, something we've been talking about this week, is the collective success of humanity mastering agriculture, industrialization. It's also the sum of individual decisions by couples and families to have children, not have children, or to have lots of children. And this week we've been reaching out to members of the soon-to-be 10 billion-person planet. We've been hearing your stories of family planning or not planning. We think each one of these stories says something about our collective awareness of global population issues. Corinne Vanderplug and Lucia Briones, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lucia, where are you listening to me from right now?
I am in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. And Corinne?
I'm calling from Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Fantastic. All right. So, Corinne and Lucia, we want to ask you about your family planning decisions. And in your case, Corinne, you are a mom right now.
I am. I'm a mom of two boys.
And what's your plan for a family? And what's your next step?
We are in the process now of adopting through the state of South Carolina, and we're hoping very much so to add two more boys to our family.
And why your decision to adopt?
I think it just stems from a belief that every child deserves a family, and there are just many children that they need a loving family.
Is there anything about the population, the sense of how we live in communities, anything about the planet that causes you to think about what's an appropriate size of a family or what's an appropriate strategy for making and creating a family in 2013, Corinne?
Absolutely not. I have just a fundamental belief that every person is an individual with, you know, purpose and a plan for their lives. And I think that when we start talking about people in terms of population, it's like comparing them to deer or to fruit flies or something like that. To me, it's not a factor in family planning.
So, Lucia Briones, how about you? What are your family planning strategies, decisions at this point?
I plan on having one child. If I want to have more later on, I will adopt.
And why did you make that decision up front?
Because I was raised as an only child, and I had a lot of attention, good attention, focused, was disciplined. My parents, they didn't have a six-figure salary, you know, combined. So I see that, you know, as a way to help contribute to the next generation. I would like to be focused, you know, on them to help bring out their creativity, to, you know, let them explore and give them the opportunities to do what they want in life. My attention won't be divided into three different children. I'll focus on that one.
And do you have a partner in this family venture?
I do. I am engaged right now. We will be married next November. Thank you.
And your husband-to-be is totally down with this one-child program?
We've discussed it. And so, yes, we would have one child. And he is very much considering adoption as well later on.
And why adoption, not continuing biological children? Is that a strategic decision or a preference,
saying? It's exactly as Corinne said. You know, every child needs a home. I feel that if this world population is just exploding, and like you said, it'll be 10 billion before we know it. And I do have a concern for the resources. I just think to myself, at this rate, the world cannot sustain all of us. So if I can help contribute to help minimize that, I would rather just have one and then take someone else's, or, you know, take in someone else. If I feel like if a whole generation did that, then it would help control the human population just a bit and maybe help sustain our planet's resources later on.
Corinne Vanderplug is a stay-at-home mom of two children in the process of adopting two more in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And Lucia Briones is marketing director for the Texas Army National Guard, who spoke with us from Austin, Texas. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What do we call this? Musical genius, right? What does Barry Manilow call this?
Spirit move me every time I'm near you.
Barry Manilow maybe calls it intellectual property when he's not thanking the ghost of Frédéric Chopin. The hit tune Could It Be Magic is based on Chopin's Prelude in C minor, Opus 28. Manilow made a bundle off that tune, but so did the Frédéric Chopin estate, or whatever it is that owns the Chopin copyrights. That's right, folks, call Chopin a genius, the original pop tunesmith, the classical romantic sap, the man who defines 19th century piano music, but just don't call him public domain. You want Chopin music in your church fundraising video, your Hollywood movie? It's a copyright issue, folks. Even though he's been dead and gone low these 164 years, you still got to pay. My next guest, Aaron Dunn, is on a mission to make Chopin IP public domain, the founder of Museopen, a nonprofit devoted to creating free public domain music resources, including recordings, sheet music, and educational materials. His new campaign is called Set Chopin Free. Joins us from San Francisco. Aaron, did I get that right? Muse Open, or how do I pronounce it?
You know, domains are hard to come by, so anything works. Muse Open is what I go by.
Muse Open. Okay, that's what we'll call it then. So why are you – I actually had no idea that Chopin – you still have to pay Chopin. Who do you actually pay to?
Yeah, so this is what makes music copyrights kind of complicated. So all his sheet music is in the public domain, but the way that most people consume it and use it is from music recordings, which are all made from CDs or more modern recordings. So all of that is still copyrighted. So I wanted to do something that puts it in the public domain the way people actually enjoy and use it, which is as music, free music recordings.
So how has this non-public domain issue complicated, say, movie soundtracks? Barry Manilow did okay, but what is it doing to people who want to use Chopin music in their media of one kind or another?
I think it's less about what it's actively doing and what it's not. I think it makes it restrictive. And it sort of works against the whole point of public domain and why copyright law exists, which is to act as an incentive for the creation of new works. So if you never actually have an artist's output in the public domain, it becomes less useful for someone who's not Barry Manilow to go find it and use it. And online, people like to mix music, they like to edit it, they like to put it in movies. You would have to know, either get a lawyer or know how to work around copyright law to do that. If you're, say, a film student, if you own a cafe and you want to play some music in your cafe, you're going to have to pay royalties. So there's a body of work that you don't need to do this for, and that's what Muse Open works to help.
You've solved a mystery for me, why there are so few Chopin samples in hip-hop music. Actually, you haven't solved that mystery. Yeah, that's ridiculous. So tell me about this campaign. How are you using crowdsourcing and social media to try to solve this problem?
So this actually follows one of our first – this is on Kickstarter. We did our first one, which hired an orchestra to record a bunch of symphonies and release that music. This time we wanted to be more ambitious. We wanted to record the life's work, the entire life's output of a composer. And this is also an experience for us to try and explore how do you then represent someone's life's work, everything they've composed, the sheet music, the music recordings. So the goal of this is to have the top piano players from all over the world record his music, give everything away for free with a public domain license, and then try and experiment on top. How do you visualize this? How do you let people explore it? We're going to have a listener's guide, which has information on every single piece. We're going to have an e-booklet for an iPad and other tablets. I think it'll be just a really interesting sort of belated birthday gift for Chopin's 200th birthday, which was only a couple years ago.
Now, of course, some people will say, birthday gift? You're giving my stuff away for free? He might be rolling over in his grave, right?
Maybe. I don't think he benefits anymore now that his music's out of copyright. If he were alive today, unless he were still composing, he wouldn't be making any money off his music. So at least this way we're in hopefully increasing the audience for people that could enjoy his music.
And the Polish government isn't going to come after you or anything in some sort of national treasure law, right?
Oh, no. We've been in contact with them quite a bit, and they just had a huge bash party for his 200th. Free performances all over the city, really country. Anything that encourages people to listen, I think, just helps them.
Is there an ideological component to what you're doing here? I mean, do you have a broad sort of view on what should be public domain, how intellectual property of people who have long passed from this earth should be used by everyone?
Yeah, there's certainly a component which, and this speaks broadly to the sort of free culture movement. And if you're afraid of familiar with someone like Creative Commons, where they have sort of variations on just traditional copyright, we believe that art begets art, and when you restrict it, you restrict the ability for new art to exist. Composer and all his contemporaries stole from each other. They didn't have copyright quite in the same way that we do today. And so it just sort of goes against the tradition of how all this art came to be in the first place. So we just believe as long as we're consistent with the law, and this is sort of the legal equivalent of what people are used to, like a Napster or whatever people download music from freely today, this is the best legal way to produce public domain recordings of all this public domain art.
And who's next? I mean, what other composers would you need to move on and take a look at? I suspect they're probably almost all in the 19th century.
Yeah, there's tons. Actually, one of the reasons we picked Chopin is we would need quite a budget to try and take on a Mozart or a Bach. It would almost certainly be in the millions. And the goal, actually, I mean, everything, ironically, is going to be in the public domain one way or another. All the CDs that exist today will be in the public domain. The goal of this is to get some amount of this music in our lifetimes available so that we can use it and enjoy it. But MuseOpen was actually incorporated. It's a nonprofit to focus not only on music recordings and sheet music, but also music education. So I think some of the next projects we're going to tackle is how do we make music education itself freely available and more accessible to anyone?
How hard is it to get musicians to play for something that they'll never have any sort of ownership of?
Well, when you look at most of the musicians either that contribute to MuseOpen already, or I believe that most that work professionally, very few make money off royalties. These are people in Hollywood that are making music for movies, and even those are getting outsourced to places like the Czech Republic, which records for computer games and Hollywood increasingly. They make money teaching and performing, and hopefully MuseOpen just draws in a larger audience and encourages more participation and shouldn't take away from any of the revenue. So they're incredibly willing. I just had a whole surge of people given this fundraiser. Some related to people in San Francisco and large symphonies that want to contribute. They just think it's a great idea.
Well, Aaron, and I suspect MuseOpen isn't going to go public anytime soon, but thanks so much. We'll go out on one of the Chopin tunes that you've actually set free. Thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Aaron Dunn is the founder of MuseOpen, a nonprofit devoted to creating free public domain music resources. Next week, we'll be bringing you our interview with Supreme Court Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She may be the second woman on the nation's highest court, but Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg started out as a litigator, a strategic champion of women's rights who revolutionized our understanding of equal protection under the law.
I didn't change the Constitution. The equality principle was there from the start. I just was an advocate for seeing its full realization. The Declaration of Independence starts out, all men are created equal. So I see my advocacy as part of an effort to make the equality principle everything the founders would have wanted it to be if they weren't held back by the society in which they live.
Justice Ginsburg on The Takeaway next week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.